Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I'm joined by just doctors Adam Francisco and Scott Keith. Today we are...
I think every time we hang out with Caleb, we should make him call us Dr. Francisco and Dr. Keith.
Yeah, it is a little awkward.
Out in town.
Yeah, around town. At the movie tonight.
It's a dilemma for me now, right? Mm. Because I think I hang out with you guys more than anybody else. But it was even worse at school. In class, because I knew almost 75% of my professors on a first name basis. In class, it was just a weird decision to what to say. But
well, it's like with Dr. Rosenblatt. For 20 years,
I've made that transition.
But today, I was lighting a pipe, so that's why a little gap there. We're going to answer some questions that we've gotten stuff like this in the past via email, but we actually have a listener on Twitter who's been messaging me and the Thinking Fellows page. And wanted to ask some questions.
Now, Twitter, that's social media, right?
That's social media. Okay. And you know what? This actually prompts me to do something I think we should do. No, it's not my life. But we on this show tend to be really bad at self-promotion. I think I've maybe told people where they can find us online, social media-wise, 5 times total. So in the last 4 years. So we should probably say that. You can find the Thinking Fellows on Twitter and on Facebook, at Thinking Fellows on Twitter. It's Thinking Fellows on Facebook. You can follow us at both locations. You can even ask questions to the show via Twitter or Facebook. We've had people do that plenty of times. I tend to check Twitter more often than Facebook just because I actually personally use Twitter and I don't use Facebook. But
are we on the gram?
At 1517 is on the gram.
Okay. Is that what it's called? Instagram's
on the gram. I am on Twitter at Caleb_Keith or something like that. You can find me. I don't even know. And Adam's on Twitter now, too, but I don't think he does much. What are you on Twitter, Adam? At Adam Francisco or something?
Probably.
Okay.
I don't know.
If you go to the Thinking Fellows page, you can find us if you want to follow us.
Yeah. I'm not on Twitter.
You're not on Twitter. You're not on... Well, you have a public page on Facebook. That's what you have.
I also have a personal page on Facebook.
Yeah, so you can actually follow, I don't know, what is it, Scott Keith, public profile page on Facebook. And Adam is at Adam S. Francisco 8 on Twitter. I'll just put it in the show notes, I guess, if you want to follow us. It's a mixed bag. I try to... Following us on social media, the main thing is if you don't subscribe to the show, you could see when new episodes are out. But in addition to new episodes... I'll tend to share blogs from my social media page that any of us on the show here have written. I'll share content from other 1517 projects that is noteworthy as well. So, I guess that's the only thing I do there. We all tend to try to not be super, super active on social media. I think that's one of the pitfalls of a lot of people is they end up kind of getting lippy on social media, and then that runs into your show or something like that. And I don't want people to be turned off from the Thinking Fellows because I said something offensive on Twitter or something like
We've gotten, not attacked, I don't want to use hyperbole, but people have critiqued us. This is maybe going back 4 or 5 months ago. It's interesting, I think it was on Twitter or something else where somebody listened to an episode and they took what we said on an episode and interpreted it in light of their narrative, if you will, and so I think that was when I got on Twitter.
It was.
And I was so antsy. I wanted to just punch back, but I said, you know what? I'll be civil. So there's a reason why we're not so active on social media, because it's easy to get sucked into controversy and
it's a hard balance, I think, between sort of like using it for good and using it for evil.
I just look at trucks.
Yeah, you just look at trucks. No, that's true. He's on Instagram and he just looks at trucks all day. And
very little controversy.
Very little controversy. Yeah. That might be the best use of social media. Yeah. Staring at trucks all day.
Or whatever your thing is.
Skateboarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mountain biking. Yeah.
So, okay, well, that's trucks. Enough social media drivel. Like I said, you can follow us there. I'll put it in the show notes. Again, we're sort of bad at the self-promotion thing. But again, we got listener questions from there. And these ones were about sort of the differences or some contrasts and compare between Lutheranism and Reformed theology, particularly like modern Lutheranism and modern Reformed. But I thought this had a historical answer, which is why we could do something like this on the show. And the basic question, and I'm just going to summarize this, is when somebody, the listener said, when somebody says they're Reformed, it's hard to tell what they mean. You have to have a pretty long conversation with them to figure out what flavor of Reformed they are. Do they baptize their babies? Do they not baptize their babies? Do they have the regulative principle? Do they not? Do what confession do they use? What style of preaching is there? It's very broad. You have everything from Reformed Baptist to sort of conservative Reformed to Reformed who feel or sound a little more Lutheran because they'll introduce some law gospel hermeneutic into their preaching and teaching. So it's a really broad spectrum, and it's why it's sort of hard to talk about it sometimes. Like we've had, I know I've critiqued my dad for sometimes being a little hard on the Reformed during the episode, but I guess the problem is I think it comes down to the same problem. Sometimes I'm thinking like Mike Horton, right? And then there's this whole other probably four or five worlds of Reformed theology out there that are nowhere similar to, teaching like Horton does or something like that. So how do we navigate that? And maybe what's the explanation for why Lutheranism doesn't seem to be like that as much? Now, I do think Lutheranism is fragmented in many ways, but I do believe there's a point here. When somebody says they're Lutheran, you can generally believe that they believe certain things about the sacraments, that they baptize infants, that the long gospel is a hermeneutical principle for them, that they have a similar confession, all this kinds of things. We may say there's definitely exceptions to some of those rules, but
yeah, well, it seems like pretty darn big ones, like the ELCA.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I would say some of those exceptions are getting bigger.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, and I mean, some would argue with, I don't know, I don't remember exactly what it was, but the ELCA this year at their convention pretty much might not be Lutheran. Is you could pretty much safely say that as a synod. I don't want to say individuals within the ELCA. There are faithful people, I'm sure, within those churches, but as a synod, the decision was sort of to abandon Orthodox Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, what could we dive into perhaps why historically that's different? I know, Dad, that you're teaching on Reformed confessions this week, in fact, you said.
Yeah, I haven't finished looking over my notes, but we can give it a shot.
You can give it your best shot.
it's interesting because Adam and I both, I think, kind of got seriously into theology at Concordia University, studying under, a lot of good people, actually. Steve Mueller, Bob Dargitz was a great professor in his own way. But being heavily influenced by Rod Rosenblatt. And at that time, Rod was on what was a radio show that was broadcast on a Los Angeles Christian broadcasting network called KKLA. And the show was called The White Horse Inn. And The White Horse Inn was a concept dreamed up by Mike Horton, who's now a very famous Reformed author. Mm-hmm. The show was much like The Thinking Fellows. In fact, when we thought of doing Thinking Fellows, a lot of ways White Horse Inn was sort of one of the things that was in the back of our mind. Mike Horton, Kim Riddlebarger, another Reformed at that time pastor, and now I think he's a PhD pastor professor, and Rod Rosenblatt, who's an LCMS Lutheran. And as Rod tells that, sort of the context of the show was a couple of confessional Reformed guys and somebody else from another confessional branch of Christianity, and that kind of had to mean Lutheran, and to be, a subscribing confessional Lutheran, that pretty much meant LCMS. And so Rod was on the show. But even as even way back then, when I'd say I certainly didn't know much, you could tell there was a difference between what it meant for Rod to be a confessional Lutheran and what it meant to be a confessional Reformed. And it was I think precisely one of the big reasons was not that they didn't believe in their confessions that they subscribe to, because I think they certainly do. But that being a confessional Lutheran meant that you actually, there that was a common language. If you were a confessional Lutheran and you were talking to another Lutheran, they knew what you meant. That meant that you subscribed to the three creeds, the Augsburg Confession, the Apology to the Augsburg Confession, the Small and Large Catechism, the Small Called Articles, Power and Primacy of the Pope, the Formula of Concord, and they knew that, right? Because that's sort of, our confessions were, and our Book of Confessions, called the Book of Concord, was locked in way back in 1580.
Yeah, and has not had any additions since.
No, and has not had any additions or amendments or addendums since then, right? And so the question within Lutheran circles then becomes, what is your confession? Do you have a quia confession, which just means because it's in agreement with Scripture, or a quotidianus confession, insofar as it's in agreement with Scripture, which we've always argued is a little more loosey-goosey. On the Reform side, I think if you're a confessional Reformed, you actually probably have to have the discussion, if you meet another quote-unquote confessional Reformed, well, which confession do you subscribe to? And there are options, and they're not sort of, to my knowledge at least, it'd be really good to have a Reformed person on the show.
Yeah, it would. I don't think this will come off as unfair, but you're right. Having somebody from one of those.
Yeah, because my understanding is that there's not a solid standard, you know. Mm-hmm. And for that matter, to be Reformed could mean that you're a Calvinist, which I would say Mike Horton and Kim Riddlebarger are classic Calvinists, and it can mean something else.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
it gets complicated there too, though. You know, if you know Reformed people, there's debates within broader Reformed circles over, you know, what really is Reformed. You get some will refer to themselves as truly Reformed.
Mm-hmm.
And then think of B.B. Warfield and his book Calvin and Calvinism.
Yeah.
Where this is what, not quite 100 years ago, but quite some time ago. He made a distinction where there's classic Calvinism, but then you have all these Calvinistic or Reformed offshoots that are influenced by Calvin, but they go in their own directions. And largely they're, the way they, not maybe not so much their particular theology, but the way they approach theology and assert their theology in, you know, contemporaneous times changes. If you spend time like with the OPC, Orthodox Presbyterian Church, very Reformed, very Calvinistic, but then you go to a PCA, which is a pretty still kind of conservative Presbyterian church body. It's quite different than the OPC. And then you get the PCUSA. That's their equivalent to the ELCA.
It's a, and then, considered a
but then you got the Reformed churches, United Reformed Church, and just all over the map. They, you know, when you get down, when I get down about how divisive Lutherans can sometimes be, I just think about the Reformed. I have a brother-in-law who's Reformed, and so it's just they break up into all sorts of different sects and denominations much more quickly than Lutherans do, interestingly.
Yeah, there's quite a few of, you know, I didn't realize this until recently, just how many smaller Lutheran synods there are too.
Yeah.
But the differences to me seem to be like relatively small.
Ecclesiology is usually as
simple as where they migrated from to the United States can be like just a huge factor in who where the allegiances fell. And you'll find that the confession from one church to another is pretty much the same with, yeah, like you said, some ecclesiological differences and likewise.
Mm. I mean, Calvin, early on, I mean, the first confession Calvin likely subscribed to in any real way was the variation, or what's called one of the variatas of the Augsburg Confession.
Mm. Yeah.
And so, and the other thing is, for the most part, I won't pretend to be an expert on all sort of the dating of all Reformed confessions, but for the most part, they come later than a lot of the Lutheran confessions too. Mm. And so sometimes up to, say, like 50 years later. And so there are, again, if you think in the history of the Reformation, there is this, you know, the movement that starts first, I don't actually hate to say it, is the Lutheran Reformation, mm-hmm. right? And this is the Reformation for a while.
Well, it predates Calvin's reform by 30-some years.
Yeah, I mean, this is the Reformation for a while. And the Protestants that are other than Lutheran that come out of the Lutheran Reformation, you know, in a lot of ways were probably themselves considered at first, early ones especially, Lutheran. And then when they started having arguments with views that Luther held or that were stated in the Augsburg Confession or the Catechisms or something like that, or in some other publication, you know, they get to be sort of their own entity in opposition to not only the Roman Church, but to Lutheranism, right? You're not Lutheran, you're Calvinist, or you're Reformed, or you're Zwinglian, or whatever, or you're Anabaptist. And these are, you know, they find themselves in opposition. Whereas when Lutheranism starts, the opposition is primarily to the Church of Rome, because that's all there is. I mean, later on, you'll start to see the Lutherans, too, writing against, especially the Anabaptists. Mm-hmm. But very, you know, especially confessionally, rarely will you see a specific writing against some type of Reformed theology that's not Anabaptist.
Mm. Yeah. Now that you say that, that's, to me, this seems where some of this stems from, is that when we use the word Reformed, those could have been three different groups during the Reformation period. That could have, people who are Reformed now may be Anabaptists in mm-hmm. practice. They could be Zwinglians, certainly, or they could be Calvinists. And when you say Lutheran, you're still sort of limited to one Reformation.
Yeah. And it gets even more complicated because the Anabaptists, well,
yeah.
good heavens, there's a whole bunch.
Yeah,
there's
right.
the, you know, the those who followed Munster, yeah. those who followed Menno Simons, and mm-hmm. you know, a whole bunch of others. Have you ever heard the claim that Calvin in particular picked up where Luther didn't, or Luther left off, or,
yeah,
or Luther didn't go far enough? Calvin's the one who takes the Reformation and the principle of sola scriptura yeah. to its greatest extent, which is kind of, you know, for us, we'd say, wait a minute.
Yeah, we'd probably point out specific areas where we think that's not true. But I could see that on, say, like issues concerning the bondage of the will.
Yep, I've heard it during via
and predestination.
Mm-hmm. Well, I, you know, the phrase always reforming.
Yeah.
That's more of a reformed
thing, yeah.
category or, yeah. or term, because they're always trying to become increasingly more reformed and
refined.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because...
It's one of the reasons we, early on when I came on board 1517, we stopped using that. Mm-hmm. As it just, it doesn't represent organically who we are as Lutherans. The goal wasn't to try to find, you know, from a human reason perspective, the ultimate refinement of our theology. That's not the goal.
Did you ever, there's a place where you and I, well, I used to work full-time up until very recently, and you used to work full-time, that in 2017 would always have,
yeah.
always reforming, yeah. and every time I'd walk, everywhere, right?
Yeah.
And to celebrate the Reformation, I remember walking by there en route to class or whatever.
Like, that's one of the instances where a large organization has a marketing department that fails to consult the theology faculty.
Yeah, that's problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, and you could see why that happens at larger organizations. I mean, there's been small instances of it at 1517 even, where
yeah.
something we do on Facebook wasn't 100% what we would, you know, the theologians in the room would have written. Mm. Yeah, but so you could see why somewhere much larger could run into mm-hmm. those problems. But yeah, it seems like Lutherans would say, like, always remembering the Reformation.
Mm.
Instead of always reforming.
Yeah, that's yeah. a good distinction. Yeah.
Hey, can I throw in a caveat? And I kind of said it that I believe I'm open to being corrected on that Calvin thing and his first sort of confessional stance being one of the versions of the Variatus. If there's a Calvinist scholar out there who can tell me that, you know, he signed on to,
because I know he did sign on to the 1546
41
Variata. I don't remember the exact one, but that's pretty early into Calvin's Reformation, too. So
yeah, I'm just open to being corrected by people that know.
Yeah. No, fair point. But it is substantial to say that at some point, I mean, Calvin mostly agreed with the Lutherans. It might be important to say, because people aren't super familiar with the Variata, especially in Lutheranism, since we try to bury it under 10 feet of gravel. that the changes that probably made Calvin accept it were changes to the wording on the sacraments, particularly the Lord's Supper.
Yeah, Melanchthon softened the language on the real presence in the supper.
Yeah.
I think basically just saying that Christ is truly present, softening it down that far, which most even just catechized Lutherans would say, well, that's all right. But when the argument was over whether Christ was actually bodily present in the supper.
Yes.
And to soften the language and say truly present, you know, Calvin could certainly get on board with that. I studied pretty thoroughly years ago his short treatise on the Lord's Supper, and he makes several sort of hypothetical arguments for how Christ could be present, even in a way bodily in the supper, that aren't the way that Lutherans normally describe it. As being, you know, with the bread and the wine, or in with and under the bread and the wine and the supper. He's got other ideas, but, you know, Calvin, on the whole, wanted to get as close as he thought he could to Christ really being present in the supper.
Yeah. I think it's important to say, too, that, like you said, Melanchthon, I think it's in the Bente introduction to the Book of Concord. Bente adds a section where he says this was Melanchthon's private stance as a crypto-Calvinist.
Yeah, that's it.
And I don't believe that's... If you even read the variation there...
A couple of years ago, your dad had me or pointed out some things in Bente's historical introduction to the Book of Concord that, you know, I had allegedly read it in undergraduate, but I probably didn't read it that closely. But it threw me for a loop that Bente's introduction is terrible scholarship.
Yeah.
Terrible historical scholarship. It's what we might call confessional scholarship, in that he's got a... This is going to get me in trouble, but whatever.
I don't think it will anymore.
He's got a conclusion
that
he dumps all his data into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Make the facts fit.
Yeah. Drives me nuts. I don't know why you bring him up.
Confirmation bias.
You've triggered me.
Why do I bring him up? Because I know. Well, because it's not a dead argument against Melanchthon as of late. To cite Bente's, he's a crypto Calvinist based on the Variata. Mm. And if you actually, the thing is I don't think most Lutherans who could make that claim have ever seen the Variata. It's not very commonly accessible. Again, because. At least in the LCMS, your confession is, you even state to the non-altered edition, to the unaltered Augsburg confession.
UAC.
Yeah, the UAC.
A lot of churches will have a cornerstone, UAC.
It's not even like commonly found anywhere. So the chances that anybody actually has read what the variation was.
Like I said, if you were to read that section of the Variata to just a decently catechized Lutheran, I think they would have trouble finding the issue with it. It's when the argument becomes hyper-specific, and it was hyper-specific for them, that it becomes an issue.
Yes.
And it makes Melanchthon seem like he's doing something underhanded, because it's not like he's unaware of where the argument was at the time and what was important. But it also, and this is, I think, I don't want to speak for Dr. Kolb either, but more to his point is that Melanchthon's task was often to find, as he's being sent out by various political leaders to get people on board with the Reformation, his task was often to find how far he could take the wording on something without being wrong, and so that they would agree to it, and to maybe cut him a little bit of slack for that, and not to just interpret his actions based on a one-sided perspective of whether what he said was theologically pure or not, but that there are other historical things going on and political movements going on.
It would have been very valuable to have the Reformed totally on your side, to have Calvin and his and Geneva totally on your side.
He could have done that by saying, and we confess that Christ is spiritually present in the supper. Yep. They would have all been like, okay. Let's go fight this war together, you know. But he didn't go that far. You know,
he stopped.
Went as far as he could without going into error, in his mind.
What could we say positive about the Reformed? Years ago, I took a course from I won't name names, but a course on Calvin. We read the Ford Lewis Battles edition of Calvin's Institutes, and there's a few parts you think, but by and large, 80%, maybe it's a little higher, is really, in terms of a rigorous scholastic approach to theology that's Protestant, you know, put air quotes around Protestant, really good.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I spent 2 years of my life outlining that thing completely.
I wish I would have had that.
Front to back. It's available.
I think you could say about modern Reformed, just prolific publishing in like lots of different areas that sometimes get left undone or done poorly by Lutherans. Like, you know, books on parenting, for instance, that are like, they just have lots of it. And they have, I think, publishing houses that reach broader audiences than Lutherans do. Too. I think that's
well. The institutes are amazing. I mean, it like I think Adam described them very well. It's a sort of classic scholastic approach to categorizing theology from a Reformed perspective.
And for the record, I prefer Melanchthon or Chemnitz, but Calvin's. Yeah.
No, but the institutes. If you're a theologian. Who, you know, who's never opened the pages of the Institutes, you're probably doing yourself a disservice. These are, even Rod said in one of the last episodes that the Institutes, you know, along with Luther's small and large catechism, probably belong in a list of books that changed the Western world, great books that changed the Western world, because they just did. We can say things like, and I can even say things like, Melanchthon's Loci were used to train Lutheran pastors for 150 years, and they were, but Calvin's Institutes went out to everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and really colored the way people, laymen and pastors alike, saw theology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I bet, I mean, this is sort of hyperbole, but I would guess more people have read the Institutes than the Loci.
You don't need to guess.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Or probably even the Lutheran Confessions as a whole.
Well, I mean, they're both where Adam referred to the Four Lewis Battles edition, which is in the Library of Christian Classics, right? Two-volume edition of the Library of Christian Classics. Melanchthon's 1521, Loci is in the Library of Christian Classics, too, in the volume Melanchthon and Bucer. And I guarantee you that the LCC sold many, 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 many more copies of the Institutes than they did the Melanchthon and Bucer.
Why do you think that is? Because it's so darn comprehensive and leaves no, at least from a 16th century perspective, no stone unturned theologically?
Don't you think Calvin's name just is more popular?
Sure. I think in America there's, I mean, certainly more quote-unquote Reformed people than there are Lutherans by a long shot. I mean, under the category of Reformed, we know many quote-unquote evangelicals that are engage with 1517 quite heavily, who at the end of the day are probably Reformed. Theologically just Reformed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when the biggest...
You know, Reformed who don't practice the regulative principle, you know?
Yeah.
That's how they're evangelical.
The most common question we get to the show, and we just got it two times again last week, and was, hey, I'm... like moving towards Lutheranism on my way. The show's been a great help. Can't get over this baptism thing. And so that, you know, that's kind of in the Reformation, that was just such a large line between the Reformed and Lutherans. It was basically, I mean, it's the one that Zwingli couldn't get over. It was, it compromised so many of the debates between Lutherans and the Reformed. And it still sort of is, I think, for us, the pragmatic issue when we have listeners write in who are from Reformed or evangelical traditions, it's still the one that's hardest to catechize people into. I guess if that makes sense. Because I feel like we've covered that the baptism and the Lord's Supper probably more than any other topics on the show, because they make it into almost every Q&A. Because every week I get one or two emails saying, I'm having a really hard time with this baptism saves you thing.
I know. We always say
biblical text, baptism now saves you.
I know. Lutherans will always, it's a instinctive reaction.
Yes, it really
Lutherans
is.
Will always answer the same way to that question, and they'll go, really? Because it's so, to use a modern word, Adam, phrase, organic to who we are, to say, you know, baptism is a means of grace.
Yep.
It's a sacrament. And it's one of the means God uses to draw the sinner to himself, i.e. to save them. And it's just so ingrained in us that we're probably bad at answering that question because we've just... It just, from the way we look at how this whole thing works, it just makes sense.
It's self-evident to us.
It's self-evident. God's going to use something and somebody to say, to just, you know, to bring you to faith. Mm-hmm. That something is going to be a means that you'll shake your head about later saying, whoa, that's weird that God used that.
I think the hang, over the years, I think I've learned the hang up is that there are so many people who know baptized Christians who are no longer Christian. Mm. It's the apostasy issue. It's just there's just such a prolific issue.
I think
with
that's
this.
Huge. But Rod always tells a story. Maybe he's told it on the show how when he taught at Westmont, he's teaching on baptism, and his students objected and say, "How is it that God would use just these earthly things to save people?"
I don't know. And, it's in the text.
Well, it's in the text, and Rod would say, "Well, think about that a little bit."
Yeah.
Yeah, the cross.
Yeah. So yeah,
fleshy body dying on a piece of wood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the physical means seems like a problem to object to.
It seems so common. So easy. Right?
Yeah.
So Heidelberg Catechism takes up this question of infant baptism.
Yeah,
so this is why you cannot paint Reformed with a broad brush and say, you know, the Reformed don't teach infant baptism.
Because a lot of them do.
Because a lot of them do. And even a lot of them sort of will use what I would say is a means of grace argument for arguing in favor of baptism. I mean, Heidelberg takes this question up in, I think it's question 72, 73, and 74, using many of the same scriptural references that Lutherans would use when answering these questions. Question 73, why then does the Holy Spirit call baptism the washing of regeneration and the washing away of sin? Answer, God speaks in this way for good reason. He wants to teach us that the blood and spirit of Christ remove our sins, just as water takes away dirt from the body. But even more important, he wants to assure us by the divine pledge and sign that we are as truly cleansed from our sins spiritually as we are bodily washed with water. I mean, that's not what Luther said, but that's, you know, that's not... Luther asked that same question in his catechism. So is it how does simple water do such a thing? Well, simple water can. It's simple water connected with the promise of the word. Should infants be baptized? Question 74. Yes. Infants as well as adults belong to God's covenant and congregation. Through Christ's blood, the redemption from sin, and the Holy Spirit who works faith are promised to them no less than to adults. That is very, we probably wouldn't use the belong to God's covenant and congregation language,
yep.
But we would say things like redemption from sin and the Holy Spirit work faith and promise to them no less than to adults. We would say the same type of thing, and we do in our confessions. Therefore, by baptism as sign of the covenant, again, we probably wouldn't use that language, it must be incorporated into the Christian church and distinguished from the children of unbelievers. Now, having said there's some similarities here, the differences that I pointed out are significant theological differences.
Yeah.
Too. Historically, you know, the way that you can discern if there is a way that you are part of God's divine covenant of election for you is your connection to an external congregation. You know, that you are connected to, legitimately connected to. And there's things that have, you know, this, there's an ecclesiology here that comes into this and how going to church is viewed and all of that, but not completely dissimilar either.
No. It's actually for these kinds of reasons that I wish more Lutherans would read some of these Reformed documents, because sometimes you don't understand when you're speaking similarly or dissimilarly to them, and you sort of have these, you know, these Reformation battles in your mind over everything, and they become unreconcilable to people today who you may actually be speaking pretty similarly to. So, I don't know. I thought
Rod has a favorite quote from the Institutes on Calvin on the doctrine of justification by grace through faith on account of Christ alone, that he'll oftentimes quote to put forward the advance the point that the Reformed on that point, the real, you know, Calvinistic Reformed are dead on.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah.
It's boy, we would, how everything works out from there, where things go increasingly haywire.
Right. And it's, you can almost see, I think, and I'm going to get in trouble for this from another perspective, but I still think it's fair to say that if there is a center to Reformed theology, it's Sola Dea Gloria. It's to God alone goes the glory. You know, God is God. God, in his divine power, can decide to do what God decides to do.
Yep.
And everything works out from that. If there is a center to Lutheran theology, at least Lutheran theology, when done well, it'll be Christ alone, or I'd say it this way, on account of Christ alone. Mm. That God's grace, which is his changed attitude towards you, is on account of Christ alone. God's gift of faith comes to you on account of Christ alone. He decides to save you in his Sola Dea Gloria on account of Christ alone. All these things are on account of Christ alone, and the center is different, and you can see that difference in center when you read the confessions, even though they're sort of arguing for the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, in the case of the Heidelberg Catechism there, they're arguing for infant baptism, but from a different center point. I think that's fair.
I hope it's fair. I do too. I don't know. I think we've done a pretty good job not, I mean, like I said, I think the Reformed do some things really well. And it's just, again, this, I think the question from the listener was an honest question and concern of why is it so much harder to identify what they believe when somebody says they're Reformed than when somebody says they're Lutheran. Yeah. And again, I think that the answers are just wrapped up in that, you know, the Heidelberg Catechism's one confession that somebody may be teaching from or confessing from, and Westminster's different, 1689. There's just a lot of options. And
I think the Reformed tradition is much more dynamic, mm-hmm. in that it's, you know, along with the lines of we talked about a bit ago about always reforming, always asking new questions about how do you interact with culture and so on and so forth. So it's always moving. It's always, and the Reformed academics are just always active in writing and publishing and so on. Whereas in the, you know, Lutheran tradition, we're, as opposed to dynamic, a little more static.
Yeah.
I mean, it's almost like, it's not that, that's, I mean, that's hyperbole, but if you just compare publications.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was saying earlier. You know, they write on, you know, modern subjects.
They're all over the map on
frequently.
Like, I just reviewed a book maybe last year on immigration from a Christian perspective. And it was by a Reformed author. It was, you know, covered a whole bunch of different things that especially focused on Islamic immigration into Europe. And you won't get books like that from the Lutheran tradition.
Lutheran, to spin it positively, we're really cautious about mixing politics with theology.
Yeah, the Reformed are much more active.
Which sometimes causes us to be silent when we do have personal opinions.
Well, we didn't have
certain issues.
We didn't have a Calvin's Geneva.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, we've always, not in watertight compartments, but always distinguished pretty sharply from the left and the right-hand kingdom. Yeah. And we're very cautious in the left-hand secular cultural arena because we don't want to say things that aren't true. Mm-hmm. And in the civil secular arena, things are, they're not relative, but a lot of things, they shift very quickly.
Well,
they develop, they progress, they regress, and so
eventually Luther and the Lutherans had Lutheran princes and electors, but they were still princes and electors. Luther himself never became the prince and elector. And that is sometimes that, like Adam said, the differences aren't as compartmentalized. And I'd say probably many historians would criticize confessional historians. I think that's what you've been saying, from saying that that line is was very sharp, and outside historians might say, well, maybe it wasn't that sharp.
Right.
But they were still princes and electors. It wasn't Luther. It wasn't Melanchthon. It wasn't Chemnitz becoming the prince and elector. And the other, you know, it was Calvin's Geneva. It was a type of theocracy.
Yeah.
And they were trying to rule for God in that place.
Yeah, yeah. And you get into the, I think it's late 20th or 19th century, early 20th century. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but Abraham Kuyper in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. a Calvinist, as Prime Minister of the Netherlands, trying to reform the Netherlands in a very different way than Calvin does with Geneva. But that's probably enough on that.
That's probably, enough. We're going to be getting outside of our like our area of expertise, I guess I'd say. Oh. I feel weird calling myself an expert on anything, so that was odd.
Yeah,
but yeah. That's okay.
I do too.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm becoming an expert on how to cart kids around on the weekends to wrestling tournaments.
That's what the next episode's about, actually.
I'm becoming an expert on Duramax diesels.
Yeah, that's not what the next episode's about. Okay. hey, thank you for listening to the Thinking Fellows podcast. If you enjoyed this conversation, we have many other shows at the 1517 Podcast Network, 1517.org/podcasts. You can go over there. I think we're up to 13 shows. It's hard to keep track of everything, but it's growing too. We have a couple shows in the works for next year as well that are of a very different flavor than what we do now. You know, we have exegetical shows, systematic theology. We have shows that cover dates in history, Christian history almanacs, daily podcasts about you know, this day in history, but in the Christian church, there's lots of different stuff going on. We also have conferences and events that you can check out. We have an event in Germany that we will have speakers at next year that I'll add to the show notes. I think we have something like 600 listeners. I have to translate the website to see what the name of this event is. It's something about freedom from what I can
see. We'll have a conference next year in Germany, Sweden, and, of course, in San Diego.
Yep.
And they'll all be focusing on the freedom of the Christian.
Yes, that's right. It has something to do with the freedom of Christian. I forgot exactly how they worded it in the website's in German, so I'm having a hard time reading that right off the bat. But
I thought you were a language
guy. Ist das nicht ein Schnitzelbank?
Wow. That's not.
No. That's German.
Sorry. I'm sorry to our German listeners. That was really offensive, I think.
No.
You ordered a hot dog. That's exactly what you did. And a beer. He ordered a hot dog and a beer, didn't he? No.
Close.
But, yeah.
Can you tell Dad's not here today?
Yeah, we can tell Rod's not here to keep it straight. But seriously, though, if you are in Europe... it is my understanding, even though I'm not a European, that it's fairly affordable to fly from country to country / travel by train or bus or something from country to country there. So I will put a link in the show notes. The pre-registration for the event in Germany is what's live now, but we will be in Sweden next year as well. And it's not 100% confirmed, but likely visiting Norway again also. So at least... To be there with some podcasting. That'd be fun.
I was trying to formulate we love Norway in German, but I don't know how to say Norway.
Don't do that. No.
You're leaving?
Isn't it just Norway?
Norway?
Norge?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. well-traveled people in this room.
Like I said, diesel trucks.
Diesel trucks. Yeah. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of The Thinking Fellows. A little more lax than usual, but I hope people enjoy it. So we'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.